Okay, so we have to finish up this business with Yiftach. We completed the discussion about his family and him being an outcast and then being brought back to fight against Amon. We had his diplomatic back and forth with Amon, his attempt to defuse the issue. That didn't work. We had him pledge that whatever would come out of his house would be dedicated to God. If he should win this war, and lo and behold, they win the war, and his daughter comes out of the house. He says, "Oh no, what have I done? I have to keep my word." And his daughter says, "Yes, you must keep your word." And she asks for a 2-month leave, and then he should fulfill his word. And we noted the debates first about what exactly he was vowing. Was it a dedication to God, or was it to be a karban? Two different views. And we noted as well the debate about why they couldn't just repeal the vow. We have a concept of Hataras Nedarim. Why couldn't they repeal the vow? And whether it was out of ignorance, whether it was out of a feeling that God fulfilled his part, so I have to fulfill my part, whether it was stubbornness, Pinchas and Yiftach, whether it was a punishment from God, all these different explanations that were offered. And that brought us to the last part of his saga. It's the beginning of Perek Yudbet, chapter 12. And that is the war with Ephraim. And we noted that we've seen this before with Ephraim back in Perek Ches, in chapter 8, after Gideon had begun his war against Midian. Ephraim said, "Hey, why didn't you summon us?" And Gideon's reaction was to say, "You know, we're not nearly as great as you. You do amazing things. We don't nearly stack up with you. Please come help us with this war." And Yiftach does not have that reaction. And instead, he rebukes them and he says, "You know, we've been suffering under Amon for years. Where you been? We didn't get any help from you. You want me to call you now? You didn't answer when I called out for your help all this time." And instead, he goes to war against Ephraim. There is something strange going on in Pasuk Daled, which we have to explain. Someone is calling somebody else refugees of Ephraim. We need to know what that means. But fundamentally, Gilead holds the border crossings at the Yiftach holds the border crossings at the Yarden. And whenever someone from Ephraim tries to escape, pretending that they're not from Ephraim, they catch him by having him say the word Shibboleth. Can't pronounce it properly. And they know who he is, and they kill him. And in the end, we said, they end up killing, what was it, 42,000? Mm-hmm. 42,000 people from Ephraim. Yeah, well, they're not punished for an inability to pronounce. They're punished because... well, not necessarily. Remember, we said there's a lot going on in this story, and none of them are good guys. Ephraim, don't think of Ephraim as, you know, righteous victims. There are no good guys in this story. We asked the question last time about why exactly Ephraim is doing this. What is this about? And we offered a few different approaches. One approach was a Barbanel's approach. They share a border with Manasseh, and they are brothers, and therefore they're really insulted. And they attack Yiftach personally, not all of Manasseh, because they think it's Yiftach's fault that they weren't summoned to battle. Malbim, on the other hand, said, "No, it's personal, because Yaakov put Ephraim ahead of Manasseh. How dare Manasseh choose who's going to be a leader? Ephraim are the leaders, not Manasseh." And then the third take was that this is part of the general theme. This was my thought. This is part of the general theme that we see here for the Jews as they face Amon. Just like Amon is born from someone who is trying to do something good but does it in a warped way, the story with Lot and his daughter. And Lot also has the same trait of trying to do something good but doing it in a warped way, as we saw in Sodom. That's what we see with Yiftach and what we see with Ephraim. Yiftach thinks he's doing something good. I'm going to take a vow and promise something to God. What could be better, right? Except anything. But that's, you know, that's Yiftach's thinking. Or even the people who kicked out Yiftach, who evicted Yiftach, right? They thought they're doing a good thing. They're taking a stand against immorality. This is the son born of the Zonah. We're not, you know, we're moving him out of society. But what they did was warped, because they made him into an outcast. And now Ephraim is saying, you know, we want to fight. We want to be part of the battle against the enemies of the Jewish people. And so therefore they say to Yiftach, we're going to burn your house down. There's just, what has happened here is that the nation has fallen so far from what they were supposed to be. They had guidance about who they're supposed to be and what they're supposed to do. They had Torah, they had Nevi'im, they had all sorts of instruction. And instead, what's happening is Ish Hayasher Bein Avyaseh, right, that phrase that we are familiar with of this era, each one does whatever is righteous in his own eyes, and it's just wrong. That's the upshot. So, we had read the story. We started explaining it. We're up to Pasuk Bet, chapter 12, sentence 2. Vayomer Yiftach Aleihem, Yiftach said to them, as we said, Ish Riv Hayisi Ani Ve'ami Ubnei Amon Ma'od. So Barbanel says there are three claims in this in Yiftach's speech to them. He says, first of all, Ani Ve'ami. It wasn't just me. It was a whole group that decided how we were going to fight against Ammon. We have been struggling. And I called you, and you didn't save me. That's the second claim. We did call you before. And then, we saw there was no help. No one was helping us. So I put my soul, my life in hand. I passed across into Ammon. And God put them in my hand. In other words, God thought I was right. So I've God on my side as well. Barbanel says you can even read similarities here to his three statements to Ammon. Right? Remember he said, God gave us this. When Ammon said, you took our land, right? One of his answers was, God gave us this land. Parallel here.
That's a legitimate answer, though. I mean, he tells us acting properly. Like, you're saying there's no good side right now. I mean,
well, there isn't, because keep on reading, right?
Well, right, afterwards, but maybe they instigated him, right?
Right. Well, that's the big question that you then have to address is, why does Yiftach reply in this way, whereas Gideon said, "You guys are wonderful," right? Used Judah essentially, and turned them into his side. Why is Yiftach being oppositional? He could say, "You're right. It was my mistake." Or he could say, we've been waiting for, keeping you in reserves, and now you have a special role that you can do. He's being, why does he reply this way? So, two different schools of thought. One school of thought, which I think is the natural response, is that this is part of his character. Gideon is more deliberate. Yiftach is a firebrand, despite seeing his attempt to negotiate with Ammon. Nonetheless, this fits with what we saw in the Medrash Tanchuma that we saw earlier, we saw last time, which condemned Yiftach for his barbaric response to them and calls him ignorant and brutal and so on. Do you remember this? We said, according to that Medrash Tanchuma, what happens with Yiftach and his daughter is punishment to him for what he does to Ephraim, because you have to read the chronology properly. The story with Yiftach and his daughter plays out over time, minimum 2 months. This story with Ephraim is right after the war with Ammon, before he's even gotten home. So the story is presented later because first, once we mention the vow, we mention how things concluded. And then we move into discussing what happened with Ephraim as a separate story. But fundamentally, this is before his daughter has come out of the house, it appears. And if not before she's come out of the house, at least before he's decided what to do. So this Medrash says, Yiftach is barbaric in his response to them, and in fact, he's punished for it. So don't look to defend and to justify. You don't need to. And that's one approach. Similarly, Rosenson, who for some reason I brought a number 3, I meant to bring in a number 1. I'm not sure exactly what I did with this. I see what I did with this, because 1 and 2 were from last time. I left them on the sheet, that's why. 1 and 2, they're good, they're Torah, but they're from last time. So we're starting with number 3. This is the Rosenson article that I quoted to you when we started Yiftach, and when we learned about Tola ben Puva and Ya'ir Agiladi, the two mini shoftim. So we talked about the lessons of Avimelech, and how Yair's experience with his kids who riding the animals and stature and naming the area, the whole bit, reflected a focus on promotion and a focus on power that said even though they're right after Avimelech, and even though they're living in the same region where Avimelech lived, they haven't learned the lessons of Avimelech. So Rosenson says the same thing plays out with Yiftach, source number 3. Gam etzel Yiftach hitcholala milchemet achim azah. He says, also with Yiftach, a war of brothers broke out, a fierce war of brothers broke out, bound up with great bloodshed. You can't free Yiftach from responsibility for it. Yiftach is guilty for this. And effectively, it closes the loop with Avimelech. Right? How did Avimelech's story begin? Sorry, Diane, you said it. Right, he kills his brothers. So we go from Avimelech, who kills his brothers, to Yiftach, who kills his brothers. That's the saga. So, that's one take. Abarbanel, who has a soft spot for Shoftim, defends Yiftach as well. He says, you can't compare what happened with Gideon to what happened with Yiftach, because, source number 4, V'hine lora Yiftach lefayes bidvarim lefnei Ephraim kemosha asa Gideon aleihem. Yiftach does not see fit to appease Ephraim the way Gideon did. V'asibaba zetli, I think it's because lefi shehem dibru leGideon b'lashon rakah. Because you know what? When they spoke to Gideon, they spoke more gently. They were fighting with him, but they spoke more gently. With him, they began with, we're going to burn your house down. You know, it's not so much that this is a justification.
If someone comes to attack you, you're going to...
You'll
defend yourself.
Maybe. So that's Abarbanel's defense. And again, you know, you have to remember, Abarbanel believed that Avimelech was also a righteous shofet somehow. So I think he has a worldview of how shoftim work that demand this kind of approach. So that brings us to Pasuk Dalet, and boy, is Pasuk Dalet hard to render. Yiftach gathers Gilad, they go to war with Ephraim. And the people of Gilad strike Ephraim, and then you get this phrase starting with Ki Amru Plite Ephraim Atem Gilad B'soch Ephraim B'soch Menashe. Those last 8-9 words in the sentence. Ori, you have the art scroll. What does it say for the translation?
Or even the rabble of Ephraim had said, of what worth are you, Gilad? You whose will in the midst of Ephraim, in the midst of Menashe.
Right, so that's one take. It's the lower class of Ephraim. Plite suggests refugees, to be a palit is to escape. But the idea here is the lower class of Ephraim had insulted Gilad, saying, you're just low-class people. You're a rabble within Ephraim and or within Menashe. So this is seen in the Targum on this, as well as Rashi. And the art school always, not always, but generally follows Rashi on these things. Malbim adds also that this fits the idea that they attacked, that Ephraim came in the first place because they believed we are superior to Menashe. You know, it's all part of that. So we look down on Menashe, you're just the rejects, you know, from us. That's one approach. Radak, and there's something similar in Dat Mikra, offer a different approach. Do any of your translations render this differently? Not the way that the art scroll read it. No, not everyone here. No. Okay. What do you have in yours for the
left? You're fugitives of Ephraim, ye Giladites, in the midst of Ephraim and in the midst of Menashe.
So yeah, so they take it the same way. So Dat Mikra and Radak, they're similar, not quite the same, but the message that I drew from it is that it's actually the other way around. Because I think you actually have to look for another approach, simply because what does that mean to call the people of Gilead you're within Ephraim? You're not within Ephraim. So Ki Amru Plite Ephraim Atem, they, meaning Gilead, said to the Ephraimites they caught, you are the refugees of Ephraim, right? Kiamu Plete Ephraim Atem. Gilad, if you are Gilad at all, It's Besoch Ephraim, Besoch Menashe. You are really, if you Giladites at all, it's the Gilad of Ephraim, and now you're in Menashe's territory.
But where is Gilad?
What is Gilad?
So there is, okay. So go back to what we did in Yehoshua. Go back to what we did in Yehoshua, and Gilad is the main area known as Gilad, is the area east of the Yarden. The central area east of the Yarden is Gilad. Menashe got it. If you go back into Chumash, Ulamachir Nasati Es HaGilad. That's the region.
City called Gilad.
Right, it's a region, really.
Uh-huh. So it's not a Jewish area.
Well, it's east of the Yarden.
It became.
Correct.
But those Giladites weren't Jewish to begin.
Our Giladites are Jewish. What do you mean?
Well, do we know that they're Jewish?
Yeah, this is Shevet Menashe.
So how did they... There was a tribe called Gilad.
No.
A group of people that lived...
No, there's a region called Gilad.
There's a region called Gilad, and they had Giladites living there.
Wait, when you say Giladite, what does that mean?
A person from Gilad, but not necessarily Jews.
No, we're talking Jews. These are Jews.
These are definitely Jews.
No non-Jews were harmed in the making of this parak. This was all about harming Jews.
We see a remote Gilad, and I see it in God.
Oh, you're right, it's in God.
No, Ramot Gilad can be a higher area, yeah. But it's, but no.
Okay.
Remember the way it worked. It's yeah. Reuven, Gad, Menashe, as you work your way from south to north.
Right.
So there could be a Ramot Gilad. There is a city called Ramot Gilad, but it's, the statement here is clearly about the Menashe community that is living in a place called Gilad. However, according to this read, Damik Radak, there is another place called Gilad in Ephraim.
That's west of the Yarden. So you're saying there's two, because they're not
correct.
Adjacent. They're far.
Yeah. And the way to read it then is that that what they're saying is, you are Ephraimites trying to run away. Mm-hmm. You may be from Gilad in Ephraim, but right now you're in Gilad in Menashe. And therefore we have
you. We're going to get you.
Exactly. In other words, let me say it a little bit differently. What this all hinges on, this whole dispute about how to read this sentence, hinges on the word ki in the sentence. Because the first half of the sentence is saying very clearly that Yiftach and crew go to war against Ephraim and they kill people from Ephraim. And then it adds ki amru and then this weird statement that's being made. So the first way to read the sentence is to say, because, key is because, they hit them, why? Because Ephraim was saying to them, you're really just Ephraimites, you don't deserve what you have, they were insulting them. The other way to take it, though, is key is more like when. They struck them, saying, you are Platei Ephraim, etc., etc. You are Ephraimites, but you're stuck in Menashe land now. So it's really all about how I read the word key.
Which was saying it?
Neither. Sorry?
Don't those two explanations switch?
Who's saying it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, because we don't know what Amru just means they say.
We don't know.
Oh, okay.
Who's they?
But in Shei Gilad is Menashe. We're taking them as Menashe.
Yes.
You see, the pause is at a 10, so how does that work? Like, you know, it seems to be Plitei Ephraim at 10.
You could fit it either way. Either, taking the first approach, you Menasheites, you're just Plitei Ephraim. Right? Because Gilad is within Ephraim, and this is one of the hard ways to read that first read, and or Menashe. The other way to read it, the second approach says, for they said, you are refugees of Ephraim. But even if you are Gilad, it's not, no one is reading it as Atem Gilad. Maybe that's what you're asking.
Right, that's what
yeah. No, no one is reading it as, everybody's reading it as Platei Ephraim Atem. Both reads have difficulty. What it really sounds like, more than anything else, is a poem of some kind. It sounds like it's meant to be some kind of a poem. Gilad besoch Ephraim besoch Menashe must be like a saying or something. But both reads are challenging.
The bottom line is Menashe's hitting Ephraim. You know.
Yes. Menashe's hitting them hard.
Hitting them hard. Ephraim's running away.
Has there always
been traditionally friction between Ephraim and Manasseh?
No.
I mean, it's like sibling rivalry.
No.
Kind of
nope. No. We see it here, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But we don't have a broader tradition of rivalry. They're usually held up as the opposite. Mm-hmm. The fact that you know, that's the classic explanation, which I don't know the source for why you say Yisimcha Elokim Ke'Ephraim HaMenashe, because look, two Jewish brothers who got along. Yeah. It's like this, how many generations to reach that point? So Ve'ilkod Gilad is Mabaros Hayarden Le'Ephraim. Gilad gets the Gilad, meaning Menashe Gilad, get the border crossings, and they catch the refugees. Vayaki Omru Plitei Ephraim, and now here, this is support for the idea, for the second approach, that Plitei Ephraim means the Ephraimites who are trying to get away. Right? That's what it meant also back in Pasuk Dalet. But when they caught them, they said to them, "Ha'efrati ata, are you from Ephraim?" Vayomer lo, and they said, "No, absolutely not. Ephraim, what's Ephraim?" Vayomer lo, and they said to them, "Emorna shibolet." Say the word shibolet, shibboleth. Vayomer sibolet, and they would say sibolet. So first of all, why did you choose that word? In other words, understanding they have come to some kind of a speech impediment, and they don't say shin, they say s instead. You could have picked any word. Why'd you pick that one? So Rashi says that it goes back to the use of the phrase Shibolet Hanahar. Shibolet Hanahar is the flow of a river. So they would say to them, what did you want to cross? And they would say, oh, the Sibolet. Where do you want to go? We want to go to the Sibolet. And then they would know, you're really from Ephraim. In other words, it's not that they're saying, say Shibolet. It's that they're saying, where are you going? And they used this word that caught them out. Radak.
All 42,000 of them?
No, the 42,000 aren't all caught at the crossings. The 42,000 are the casualties of the war. I don't know what good means in that sentence, but yes.
I mean, well, it's hard to.
Radak says that they use many words. This is just an example. You know, use whatever word you wanted to use to catch them. The big question is, why couldn't they pronounce it?
Yes.
I mean, all the people have one big speech impediment. Like, what?
Like, Greek people can't say shun.
So,
it's not in their language.
So, Radak has this really bizarre statement, which, I mean, it's not bizarre for him. I mean, he's 13th century, and I think that may explain why. But take a look. No, I didn't bring it. Huh, I thought I brought it. Okay, it's not on here. So I'll say it outside. Radak says that he thinks it could be a function of climate. In his day, he said French people had trouble saying the letter tough. He thinks it could be a matter of climate. I didn't know what that meant, but that's what he said.
You're trying to get too hot.
I don't know. But Rabbi Zion Uziel, who was a leading rabbi in Israel in the 1950s, earlier and until the 1950s, said that it came from living among people who didn't use that sound as one of their phonemes. You know, in the same way that the original pronunciation of the letter saf, right, tough without a dagesh in it, in Hebrew seems to be tha, not ta, not s, but tha. And Yemenites to this day still do that. However, those who moved into other lands where there was no letter tha, they either turned it into a ta or turned it into a sound. They didn't have that phoneme. It wasn't part of their speech. Or similarly, and I think more familiar to people, the way that Yemenites will say the letter ayin. Ayin originally, without question, was a guttural. It was a the sound. Yeah, but when you live in a place where that's not a sound in your alphabet, you know, it's not in your set of phonemes, so you find something else that approximates it, and over time, that's how this works. So the argument goes, the problem with this is just linguistically. I don't know. Well, not 2 minutes ago. It's been 300 years since they got out of Mitzrayim. Since they entered the land. It's been 300 years.
Same language. That's what's one thing when you're two people speaking two different languages. It's not in your dialogue. But these are two sets of Jewish people. They both speak the same language, whatever it be, Hebrew, Semitic, whatever, you think they both have the same.
So what's the answer? You know what the answer is.
We can't pronounce Reish for Lamed.
Oh, we learn.
I think Lamed we do okay.
Lamed? No, because it's not le, it's like a softer kind of thing. Most of us can't.
I think the answer is that because they, remember, we talked a lot about how Shoftim is about the tribalization of the Jewish people. This is, they've gone native to the extent that they're communicating much more with their neighbors than they are among Jews. And they're using whatever dialect of some, you know, ancient Near Eastern language their neighbors are using. That would be the argument. So, no longer are they able to do the shah very well, and that's how they get caught, and that's how they get killed. And that is the end of Yiftach's story. Pasuk Zayin. Vayishpot Yiftach es Yisrael sheish shanim. Yiftach ends up being a shofet, whatever that means, for 6 years. And then he dies, vayikaver be'arei Gilad, and he got buried in Arei Gilad, the cities of Gilad. As we noted, this could be his punishment, the whole business about him losing limbs and so on, and he's buried in the cities of Gilad, or it can mean one of the cities of Gilad. The Drash notes the ambiguity of Arei. However, there's a really interesting take from Ralbag, which I like. I don't know that it's correct, but I like it because it helps connect stories in this part of Shoftim. Source number 5. Vanachonetz Li, he says, you know what I think is correct about his burial in Arei HaGilad? Ki Yiftach mipnei shelo hishirach rav bein obat yenikra bahem shemo. Since Yiftach did not have a son or daughter after him to carry on his name, yeah, whose fault is that? Tziva sheyigbu asmosav b'chol, I should have thought. Tziva sheyigbu asmosav b'chol Arei Gilad k'tas po u'k'tas po. He said he wanted to have graves in the various cities of Gilad, so that they would all remember in all those cities, there's a monument for him, that because he saved the people there from the king of Ammon.
He wanted this for himself.
What is this? Yeah.
He wanted it for himself.
Yeah. So what is it? But what does this remind you of?
The woman.
No, who wanted a memorial after him for his victory leading the Jews? Ooh. Gidon. Remember the gold jacket? Right? He takes the gold and has it melted down and turns it into this ephod, right? He wants to make a monument. And the result of that was that it ended up being used for Avodah Zarah. You know, this is all the same theme. Trying to do something good, ish hayashar beinav, right? Each one trying to do something good, and just doing it in a warped way. You know, ending up with something that's not good. So, to summarize what we've done here with Yiftach, we've seen the theme of, you know, trying to do good but being horribly off base. Starting with the brothers and what they did, and moving into Yiftach and his daughter, and then going into Yiftach and the war with Ephraim, and then moving on to this, you know, Ralbag on his burial. We learned a lot about taking vows, specifically don't. Except for the idea of Beis Tzara in a time of trouble, yes, there is some kind of merit to it, and that presumably is what Yiftach was trying to do. We saw the problem of ignorance / stubbornness leading to what happened to Yiftach's daughter, and Ephraim's ingratitude and hubris, and Yiftach's reaction. Right? Whether we don't like his reaction, or we take Abarbanel's view that defends it. Okay. Good. Clear so far? Okay. I'm going to actually break the recording here.